Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Deb Calvert, and we will speak about her new breakthrough book, which she co-authored with James Kouzes and Barry Posner, Stop Selling and Start Leading, How to Make Extraordinary Sales Happen.
In B2C, it's more common to pay attention to customer experience, and it's more common to do research with buyers and to be nimble and responsive to buyers. So that was the first thing in my mind was, why don't we do more of that in traditional B2B selling? Especially when you look at some of the research around things like going way back, Gilmore and Pine, they wrote the book called The Experience Economy, must be almost 20 years ago. And they predicted exactly what's happening, that it's no longer adequate to provide good service, that you have to create a personalized, meaningful, relevant experience for each and every buyer. But that next level is, how do you create transformations, that people are shopping for transformative, not just any experience, but one that will transform how they think, how they act, how they do business. And given the pace of change that we're all experiencing, that makes perfect sense to me.
Deb Calvert authored Discover Questions and Stop Selling and Start Leading, founded the Sales Experts Channel, is president of People First Productivity Solutions, and is a certified sales and executive coach. She is one of the 65 most influential women in business, a top 30 global sales guru, and an inductee into the Sales Hall of Fame. Now, on to this insightful episode with Deb Calvert. Deb, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm delighted to have you. And, you know, I've been after you for a while. So thank you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for your persistence. I am really thrilled to be here. I love the work that you're doing here. Well, I love all your work. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much. You have written a book before. This is your second book, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
When did you decide to write this book, and how did the process start right at the beginning?
Well, it was a lining of the stars, something that was meant to be. But it's a little embarrassing how it came to me, only because it took so long. In my business, People First Productivity Solutions, I have had three separate tracks of business, but primarily two: sales productivity and leadership development. And I would go day to day, waking up and looking, you know, what customer am I working with? Okay, today's a day for leadership development. The next day, today's a day for sales productivity. And these were very separated things in my mind. The leadership development work I did was with Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner. They're well known globally as pioneers, thought leaders around the behaviors that make leaders effective. Very much an evidence-based system that they have. So being their student and them being my mentors and being well steeped in the work that they did, it's embarrassing that I didn't come to this idea sooner. But I literally one day while I was doing some sales training, I had this idea like a lightning bolt out of nowhere. And the idea started with the question, what would happen if the behaviors I teach leaders were behaviors that sellers also used? What would it make a difference? Would it be something that buyers liked? And it was just a curiosity, but I took that to Barry Posner first, and I said, well, what do you think about this? And he said, well, let's research it. because he is an academic, previous dean of a business school, and a researcher. And so through Santa Clara University, we commissioned a big panel study with 530 B2B buyers. We used the work of Jim and Barry about leadership behaviors, and that's the research. And from the research, it was clear that a book needed to be written.
See, it's really fascinating because I have not heard of this level of depth of research. And I think it's understandable because you worked with two academics. And possibly, I think that's how academics approach a problem or idea, that we need to go out and check it out in the field. So tell me a bit about how the idea of actually researching buyers came about.
The idea of researching with buyers, that is something that sadly we don't see enough of in the sales world. But that was also the premise of my first book. My first book was based not only on observations of sellers, but research with buyers. And so I already knew that that was important.
Right, right. What did you decide? I mean, how elaborate was this research? What was the process?
Okay, so it was a panel study. So a hired firm, Qualtrics, going out and finding B2B, business-to-business buyers. We wanted a cross-section of all different sorts of sectors and industries, age groups, experience buying, some from organizations where what they purchased included a complex sales process, others more of a simple process. So there was a lot of thought put into who will be in our panel so that we could get that cross-section. And then the study itself was also quite extensive because we were asking a number of questions about each one of 30 proven leadership behaviors. So it was quite in-depth. And then after we collected all of that research, there was also a phase two. We went to sellers, and this was more of an all call. We just gathered stories from everybody who would give us them, but we never used the word leadership. We just went to sellers and said, tell us about your personal best in selling. We want your story about your personal best in selling. And then we crossed what we saw buyers wanted and what happened when sellers felt they were at their personal best, and we looked in their stories for those behaviors to see proof of match.
That's quite a complex process from what I'm trying to sort of gather, because there could have been scenarios that stories wouldn't have matched to the traits that you are trying to write about, right? Or were you sure from your experience that those stories actually exist and you will find those stories?
Yes, yes. No, but we had over 500 stories submitted, and it was crystal clear. It was very compelling. When sellers felt like they were at their best, we could go to any story and see clear demonstration of leadership behaviors. And so the book has the research from buyers and the stories from sellers so that it's something that anyone could choose if they wanted to use as a behavioral blueprint.
This is fascinating, actually. So let's now get to the title of the book. Stop Selling is, how did you arrive at the, I mean, was this something just popped up in your head saying that, look, I think this is what the title should be? Or was it a part of like many titles you tested out?
It was really something we heard from buyers, even before the research, because I work with sellers, I research with buyers. I had heard this sort of thing quite often, not exactly in this phrasing, but buyers saying, stop selling to me, right? Just talk to me. There was a frustration on the part of buyers when they feel that sellers are salesy and doing these things that they associate with stereotypical negative sales behaviors. So the intention of the title is to say, you got to quit one thing and replace it with another, a behavioral set.
What was the reaction from sellers? Because these are folks you are talking to day in, day out, right? They are the source of your business. These are the guys who are coming to you and they're your customers, so to say. What kind of reaction did you see from them when you say that read this book, this is what I wrote, you need to stop selling?
Well, I think this will be no surprise to you. For some people, this book has been a breath of fresh air. It's been exactly what they're looking for. It's no accident that it starts with someone the first story in the book is someone who left sales because of feeling that they could never take on those selling behaviors they thought they had to. Right. So for many people, this is refreshing. But for others, just the notion of stop selling is offensive. And to think that they need to make behavioral changes or that buyers know what sellers should do, right? This is something that's a big leap for them. We can often get there if they'll listen to the premise and understand that actually the book is full of successful, very successful sellers' stories. But it's hard for people to make a shift, and they don't quite always understand what we're after here.
Fair enough. So let's get into the book. From what I understand, the structure is A, you talk about the change in the buyer or the need to understand buyer expectations and buyer preferences. So that's how you start off the book. And then you go into depth of the five practices that you talk about across many chapters. So let's start with the first. When you were writing about understanding buyer expectations or buyer preferences, what is it that you found from the research, and what is it that you already knew in terms of changes happening, yet we are not paying attention to them?
Yes. Well, in B2C, it's more common to pay attention to customer experience.
Yes.
And it's more common to do research with buyers and to be nimble and responsive to buyers. So that was the first thing in my mind, was why don't we do more of that in traditional B2B selling? Especially when you look at some of the research around things like going way back, Gilmore and Pine, they wrote the book called The Experience Economy, must be almost 20 years ago. And they predicted exactly what's happening, that it's no longer adequate to provide good service, that you have to create a personalized, meaningful, relevant experience for each and every buyer. And that's now the new threshold. If others are giving experiences and people are buying experiences as much as they are products, it becomes the leveler. And if you're not doing that, you're left out. So then how do you start thinking about the next level they predicted? I think that we're there. But that next level is, how do you create transformations, that people are shopping for transformative, not just any experience, but one that will transform how they think, how they act, how they do business. And given the pace of change that we're all experiencing, that makes perfect sense to me. So as we're thinking about what buyers want, that sort of research also was factoring in our own research, but we were looking to see, does this make sense in the context of other larger bodies of research out there? And it certainly did. So that's why we wanted to frame up and start the book with, hey, this is the world now that we're living in, and we wanted to give that sort of context. We included research around buyer euphoria and around the fact that buyers, we know from Kolsky, that buyers, 89% of them, will pay more for an experience than a superior product. I think that's profound to think in those terms.
That raises a question. See, if I'm selling Disney World, I know how to approach experience, right? So yes. There's this famous story that they decided that when people are standing in a queue, they will have jugglers and magicians coming to the queue and just basically entertain people who are standing in the queue so that they get a feeling that they're not waiting too long. So the point is, how do you do that when you are selling, say, ERP software? What experience are we talking about here?
Yes, well, there are many levels, and these are defined in the book too somewhat. So one level of experience is, we're just going to have a human-to-human connection. That's not something that's nice to have. It's not just the softer side of selling. It's the differentiation. It's what makes someone come to you and refer others to you and to see you differently and to remember you when it's time to make a purchase. So it's about your own personality coming out and you truly demonstrating that interest and real concern and care for another person before you try to use some slick sales technique to close the deal. Service is also a kind of experience, but it can't be just the cut and dried. Now it's about how do I give the customer an experience in shaping the service and product that they're going to receive? That's an experience. It includes, how do you prefer that we communicate? What are your preferences for delivery? What are the, of course, the customizations about the product? Who's going to be working with you on our team, on your team? Whenever they have their own imprint on shaping what they are ultimately going to receive, that's an experience. And it's an experience that's hard to walk away from, because now it's your own. And if nobody else is offering something that's yours and yours alone, of course you're going to make a choice to have that continued experience and ultimately make that purchase.
What, according to you, will be a prescriptive solution to the fact that the salesperson can only do so much? A lot of the experience will be post-purchase, and there'll be other folks involved in the delivery of the experience actually. So how much responsible can they be, and how do they ensure that the continuity of whatever standards they have set or the expectations they have set is actually ensured by the organization and the colleagues who are going to come into force after the sale is over?
Yes. Well, really, there are two answers. The first answer is absolutely entire organizations should be thinking about the customer experience and making sure that they are resourced and communicating internally in ways that afford the salesperson to give what they've promised. However, that doesn't always happen. It does not mean that the seller should wait around or should give up if the rest of the organization isn't quite there yet. A seller can, as a leader, step into that role and do their very best with the things that they do control to provide the experience that's going to be good for the buyer. And in fact, the behaviors of leadership are something the seller completely controls, and those too are an experience for the buyer.
Fantastic. It's time for a short break. Deb was talking about the 30 leadership attributes that buyers look for in sellers. One of the most critical, buyers look for a two-way dialogue. As we come back, Deb will tell us more on her findings that went into the book. One thing the buyers are not looking for is a unidirectional pitch directed at them. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. As we went into the break, Deb started talking about one key finding from her extensive research with 500 plus buyers about what they look for in a salesperson. A two-way dialogue ranks right up there in their wish list. Let's listen to Deb as she walks us through the nuances. Are there other nuanced outcomes that you saw in terms of buyer preferences besides the experience bit?
Absolutely. We did measure 30 behaviors. We asked buyers to give us a baseline. Of the sellers that you currently choose to do business with, how frequently do you see these behaviors? We wanted that baseline.
Right.
And then we said, you know, what would be the ideal frequency? Because we wanted to see how much of a contrast would there be. And we asked them then, if you saw this more frequently, would you be more likely to meet with that seller? Would you be more likely to buy from that seller? And so forth. So I could give you 30 specific sorts of things, because buyers did want higher frequency in all 30 of those leadership behaviors. I'll give you one as an example, because I think it has something every seller can relate to, and it's a fix that I believe is very important. That goes back to my first book. It'll show my own bias here. But one of the top-rated behaviors, after we knew that they liked all 30, we asked our buyers to tell us which ones then are most important. So one of the top rated by the buyers is that they want a two-way dialogue. They don't want a pitch that's one direction. It's a monologue. They do want to be involved. This is part of that experience. They want to be heard. They want to contribute. They want to shape. And so this two-way dialogue, what it means when you go through and you look at all the comments from the buyers and you do the natural follow-ups that you could imagine, what it really translates into is that a diagnostic needs assessment. A diagnostic discovery process alienates buyers. They feel that most of it's qualifying them. They feel like it's boring. They feel like it's a survey. They know you're going to use the information against them. So a diagnostic discovery process is not going to work as well as we in sales would like for it to work. But a dialogic discovery, a dialogic needs analysis is far superior. It does engage the buyer. It does provide the experience. It creates trust and bonds, and it makes it so much easier to enter into that relationship that ultimately results in what the seller wants, a closed sale.
Let's unpack this. This is a very, very interesting point, because for most people, both the processes would look very similar. Although one is led by questions, the first one, the second one is led by exchange, but for a salesperson, both the processes look very, very similar. How do you actually make that shift from a probe to an exchange?
Yeah, to explain that, I have to reframe what you said just a little bit. Hmm. Both are led by questions. The big difference is the quality of the questions. In the traditional diagnostic needs assessment, there's a list of questions and they have short answers, and we're segmenting our buyers because of how they answer. There's a lot of qualifying going on. And a seller often doesn't even know what to do. They don't even know why they're asking some of those questions. They're just on a list and they're supposed to ask them. It's the equivalent of going into your doctor's office and the doctor is asking you questions to try to decide if you have problem A or problem B, necessitating prescription one or two. It's a very meant to be efficient process. But buyers resist it because they don't want to be boxed in and they do want to be heard. So a dialogic needs assessment uses different kinds of questions. And those are all in my first book, Discover Questions, are questions that buyers like.
Yes.
The questions are, of course, more open-ended, but it's not just the phrasing of the question. It is the ability of the question to yield the floor over to the buyer so the buyer can think and be challenged and see value in the conversation because they are being challenged and forced to think about something differently. And they do more of the talking because the questions are intended to create something that hasn't been there before. The thought, the dialogue comes from those questions.
Let's move to the prescriptive part of the book, and let's talk about the five practices which you have put forth as the way to make the shift from selling to leading.
And we can play a little game here too, if you like. So I do this with sales groups when I speak to them. It's actually sure. A very interesting sure. sort of premise. So I'll challenge your listeners to do the same. The five practices. This comes from the original work of Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner. It's 35 plus years of work. It's 5 million plus people who have participated in that research. And so it's quite significant. The five practices, each of them includes six behaviors. That's where this 30 behaviors comes from.
Right.
And every single one of these is proven to make a leader more effective. Others more willingly choose to follow that leader and are more engaged by that leader when they use these five practices of exemplary leadership or 30 behaviors. So that's what it's all about.
Right. Let's talk about the five practices at least at a high level so that people get a glimpse of what you're talking about.
Okay, so I will describe each of the five practices, and I'll challenge you and your listeners to think from the buyer's perspective, out of the five, which one did they rate as the most important? They liked all five, they want all five, but the game will be, which one do you think buyers like the most?
Sure.
Okay, so the first practice is to model the way. And to model the way means to know your own values, to know what's important to you, to make sure that you, outwardly what you do is true to your values and that you're consistent and therefore credible. What you say and what you do and what you believe are all aligned. And that makes you a good example to others. The second of the five practices is to inspire a shared vision. And by the way, every one of the words that's chosen here is significant. To inspire a shared vision, the word inspire means to breathe life into. And you do this over and over and over again as a leader. You breathe life into the vision, not just your vision, but the shared vision between you and others who you would like to see following you. Inspiring a shared vision means that you understand what's important to other people and that you enlist them because you show them how their own long-term interests can be realized by the vision. Okay. The third of the five practices is to challenge the process. And this is all about experimenting, taking risks, looking for ways to continually improve. When you challenge the process, you're asking questions like, what's new? What's next? What else? Instead of being complacent in the status quo, no matter how good it might be. Okay. Fourth is enable others to act. And this practice is all about collaboration, cooperation. It's about bringing others' potential out. It's about getting them to participate in decisions that will affect them. And then the last is to encourage the heart. Here again, the words are significant. Encourage. I'm pouring courage into. And I'm not pouring it into the brawn, not into the brain, but into the heart. Encourage the heart because emotionally people need to be engaged. They need to be buoyed. Their spirits need to be lifted when the going gets tough. So this includes praise, recognition, affirmation, all the things that give people that little extra something so that they continue toward the shared vision. All right, so Subhanjan, I'll ask you first, out of the five, which one do you think that buyers felt was most important of all?
Yeah, so I'll tell you two answers. I know you don't want two, but I'll give you the one. My thought about being counterintuitive is to go with the last, which is encourage the heart, because this is completely not business, right? We are talking of B2B buyers. But, you know, my brain is telling me it's inspire a shared vision. So I'll go with inspire a shared vision, but
Okay.
So, you tell me, how did I do?
I have interesting things to tell you about both of the ones you picked. It says a lot about you. So when I do this with groups of salespeople, sometimes very large groups, I ask for them to vote. And without exception, every group of salespeople that I've ever spoken to, sales managers the same, they have always said, inspire shared vision must be the one that buyers want most of all. Well, this will be surprising because, remember, buyers want all of them, but that's number five. Inspire shared vision is the least of the five practices that buyers want. They want them all, but they rated the other four higher. And I think it's partly because they already expect this from sellers and because the old stereotypical seller inspiring a shared vision sometimes means, unfortunately, overpromising, saying things that are a little bit beyond what the true vision could ever even hope to get close to. Mm-hmm. So it's important, but it's number five. Now let me come back to encouraging the heart, because the one difference that we found as we looked at the buyers and demographic groups, the one difference we found had to do with that practice. So I'll come back to tell you what that was all about. But for buyers, by far, like number one was here and then it was 2, 3, 4, 5. By far, the number one practice that they want more of from sellers is enabling others to act. Because this is the one that dignifies them, that involves them in the decisions that will affect them, that's all about collaboration, meaning doing something with your buyers, not for them, certainly not to them, but it's the with, the engagement that is found in enable others to act. And that is where two-way dialogue, that particular behavior shows up. Okay, so
very interesting.
We did. We looked at all our buyers. We sorted them demographically to see if there were differences in complex selling versus less complex, in age groups, in places, you know, that they were located, companies, big, small. The one aberration was in number two, the second practice. All age groups, all demographics enable others to act was top. But and number two, for all age groups except for one and for all other demographic variables, number two was model the way. People really want sellers to be more credible and to be more aligned and show that integrity. But there was one age group where they put encourage the heart at number two instead of at number three like other groups did. And that group was in our under 30 buyers. However, one of the buyers in the group gave us a comment. This buyer was in the 50 plus age group. And that buyer said, the most important thing to me is when a seller thanks me and genuinely appreciates the work I'm doing, which would be an encourage the heart sort of behavior. So it's not exclusive to the younger buyers. And I think the words, the most important thing, and I thought about this and I've observed lots of sellers on sales calls, and it does strike me that we don't do this very often in sales. We wait, the contract is signed, we say thank you, but we forget that during the sales process, inside their own organization, buyers are working very, very hard. They're taking risks to say no to some other vendor. They're championing change that others inside their organization are resisting. They're sticking their neck out to get some sort of budget allocation. They're doing a lot of work, and they need encouragement from us for that internal work that we often forget is being done at all. Enable others to act, model the way, encourage the heart, challenge the process, inspire a shared vision. That's the overall order that buyers want to see.
One interesting point that you said, are we saying that the millennial buyers are more driven by empathy? Is that what is coming out when you say that the sub-30s are ranking encourage the heart in number two?
I think that would be a fascinating next study. It would require follow-up research to go quite that far. I would say it suggests that there is a greater need for us to be empathetic and appreciative and showing that genuine recognition of the work that buyers are doing. Certainly couldn't hurt. So even without the research, why not give that a try? It's free. It's easy. It's already something you know how to do.
Right. Absolutely.
So there's no risk.
Yeah, and I can sort of make sense because finally a human being is buying from another human being. And I think that what the millennials were doing, the rest of the world has moved in to that world post-COVID because we are more remote, we are not meeting people. I think that's a very interesting and fascinating sort of finding that you just shared. And I think a lot of balance has to be brought into our process of being human while we are actually so far and removed and not in the physical contact anymore. So the challenges are many. Is there anything that you'd like to add to this?
Well, I would like to add that although it seems like a very big change to make, to provide a unique experience for every single buyer, I just want people to understand it's quite simple. Any one of these 30 behaviors is something that you could do more frequently. And what we were measuring is frequency of behaviors. That's what buyers want. So you just choose one behavior, work on two, eventually get to 30 if you can. But you'll be differentiated just because you've picked one and done that thing more frequently. So it's actually easy once you know what to do and why it matters to do it. And that's where liberating the leader inside yourself comes from, is making those choices and more frequently demonstrating those behaviors. What leaders do is they guide people to a place where they want to go, but can't get to on their own. And that's truly noble work, just like selling is truly noble work when it's done right.
Yeah, so what you are saying is make the shift of these 30 behaviors into habits. If you can sort of make this shift where it becomes natural, like muscle memory, right? And it was part of our world, Deb. I mean, being graceful was not something you had to do. It came naturally to you. So the world which is forgetting part of those traits, I think this is a very important point that you're making. The frequency of doing it and do one. Start with that. And that will make a difference.
It will. We know that because of the stories we collected from sellers. And certainly since then, I've been very mindful in paying attention to this. And I've seen examples where when sellers turn up a certain behavior, it does make an impact. And it also improves the way you feel about selling. There are a lot of sellers out there who don't feel good about the work of selling because they believe it has to be those stereotypes. Well, discard that notion. Here's what we know works and what buyers want. And this feels good. This is ennobling to yourself and others.
And the interesting part of this is that you do not need your organizational structure and process to change to do this because you're doing this to yourself, right? You can make that choice and you can start the change.
Absolutely. Leadership is, I appreciate that you ended there because leadership is a choice. It's got nothing to do with title, nothing to do with permissions. Leadership is a choice we all can make in everything that we do to behave a certain way. Nothing more, nothing less.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Deb, thank you so much for coming on Bits About Books. I'm delighted and thank you for making time early in the morning. We should talk about your previous book though. We should talk about that. I think it's an important book. Questions is the basis of communication and basis of showing interest. But we'll keep it for the next one.
I will be looking forward to coming back. Thank you so much for letting me come in today.
Thank you. We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.